instructions with good, if exasperated, grace. He contented himself with completing a book on the mechanics of summoning, and put his other inquiries aside. The year aged, and in due time came the Nile's annual inundation. The floods went down. The dark earth shone fertile and wet. Crops were planted. A new season began. Sometimes the queue of supplicants at Ptolemy's door was lengthy, at other times less so, but it never went away entirely. And it was not long before this daily ritual became known to the black-robed priests of the greater temples, and to the black-hearted prince sitting brooding on his wine-soused throne. Chapter 5. Nathaniel. A disrespectful sound alerted Mandrake to the return of the scrying-glass imp. He put aside the pen with which he was scribbling notes for the latest war pamphlets, and stared into the polished disc. The baby's distorted features pressed up against the surface of the bronze, as if it were frantically trying to push free. Mandrake ignored its writhing. "Well?" he asked.
"Well what?"
The imp groaned and strained. "Where's Bartimaeus?"
"Sitting on a lump of masonry 26 miles southeast of here in the shape of a long-haired girl. Very pretty she is and all, but she ain't coming."
"What? He refused?"
"Yep. Ooh, it's dreadful tight in here. 6 years I've been inside this disc with never a glimpse of home. You might let me out, you really might. I've served you heart and soul."
"You have no soul," Mandrake said.
"What did Bartimaeus say?" "I can't tell you. You're that young. It was rude, mind. Made my ears wax up. Well, he ain't coming voluntarily, and that's all there is to it. Burn him and have done, I say. Can't think why you ain't snuffed him already. Oh, not back in that drawer again! Can't you have mercy, you hateful boy?"
With the disc wrapped and the drawer shut fast, Mandrake rubbed his eyes. The Bartimaeus problem was growing intractable. The jinni was weaker and more cantankerous than ever, almost useless as a servant. In all logic, he should let him go, but, as always, he found the thought distasteful. Quite why was hard to say, since alone of all his slaves, the jinni never treated him with anything approaching respect. His abuse was tiring, exasperating beyond measure, and also oddly refreshing. Mandrake lived in a world where true emotions skulked forever behind politely smiling masks. But Bartimaeus made no pretense of his dislike. Where Ascobol and company were emollient and fawning, Bartimaeus was as impertinent now as the day he first met him, back when he was just a child, owner of an entirely different name. Mandrake's mind had drifted. He coughed and drew himself up. That was the basic point, of course. The jinni knew his birth name. A risky thing for a man in his position. If another magician summoned him and learned what the demon knew... He sighed. His mind trundled from one well-worn track to another. A dark-haired girl. Pretty. No prizes for guessing the jinni's disguise. Ever since Kitty Jones had died, Bartimaeus had used her shape to mock him. Not without success, either. Even 3 years on, visualizing her face gave Mandrake a sharp pang in his side. He shook his head in weary self-reproach. Forget her. She was a traitor, dead and gone. Well, the wretched demon was of no importance. The pressing issue was the growing disruption caused by the war. That and the dangerous new abilities appearing among the commoners. Fritang's tale of the egg-throwing urchins was just the latest in a long line of troublesome accounts. Since Gladstone, magicians had observed a basic rule. The less commoners knew about magic and its tools, the better. Thus every slave, from the scrawniest imp to the most arrogant afreet, was ordered to avoid unnecessary exposure when out on their master's business. Some utilized the power of invisibility. Most went in disguise. So it was that the myriad demons thronging the streets of the capital or rushing above its rooftops went, as a rule, unnoticed. But now this was no longer the case. Each week brought new accounts of demonic exposure. A flock of messenger imps was spotted above Whitehall by a squealing group of schoolchildren. Magicians reported that the imps had been correctly disguised as pigeons. They should not have aroused suspicion. Days later, a jeweller's apprentice, newly arrived in London, ran wild-eyed down Horse Ferry Road and leapt over the river wall into the Thames. Witnesses claimed he had screamed warnings of ghosts among the crowds. Close inquiry revealed that spy demons were at work in Horse Ferry Road that day. If commoners were being born with the power to see demons, the disruption that had lately plagued London could only get worse. Mandrake shook his head irritably. He needed to visit a library, look for historical precedent. Such an outbreak might have happened before. But he had no time. The present was difficult enough. The past would have to wait. A knock at the door. His servant entered unobtrusively, keeping well away from the pentacles on the floor. "The deputy police chief is here to see you, sir." Mandrake's forehead wrinkled in surprise. "Oh, really? Very well. Show her up." It took 3 minutes for the servant to descend to the reception room 2 floors below and return with the visitor, giving Mr. Mandrake ample time to draw out a small pocket mirror and inspect himself carefully. He smoothed down his shorn hair where it stuck up in a tuft. He brushed a few motes of dust from off his shoulders. Satisfied at last, he immersed himself in the papers on his desk. A model of zealous, well-kempt industry. He recognized that such preening was laughable, but he did it anyway. He was always self-conscious when the deputy police chief came to see him. A brusque knock. With light feet and deft, decisive movements, Jane Farrar entered and crossed the room, carrying an orb case in one hand. Mr. Mandrake half stood courteously, but she waved him back down. "You don't need to tell me what an honour this is, John. I'll take it as read. I've got something important to show you." "Please." He indicated a leather chair beside the desk. She sat, laying the orb case heavily on the table, and grinned at him. Mandrake grinned back. They grinned like two cats facing each other over an injured mouse, sleek and strong and confident in their mutual distrust. The Golem affair 3 years earlier had ended with the death and disgrace of the police chief Henry Duval, and since then the Prime Minister had not seen fit to appoint a successor. In fact, in a mark of his increasing distrust of the magicians around him, he had awarded himself the title, and relied upon the deputy police chief to do most of the work. For 2 years, Jane Farrar had fulfilled this role. Her aptitude was well known. It had allowed her to survive a close association with Mr. Duval and work her way back into Mr. Devereux's favour. She and Mandrake were now two of his closest allies. For that reason, between themselves they were achingly cordial. Nevertheless, their old rivalry bristled beneath the surface. Mandrake found her disconcerting for another reason. She was still very beautiful. Her hair long and darkly gleaming, her eyes wry and green, beneath long lashes. Her looks distracted him. It took all the confidence of his maturity to keep pace with her in conversation. He slouched casually in his seat. "I've got something to tell you, too," he said. "Who's first?"
"Oh, go on. After you. But hurry up."
"Okay. We must get the PM interested in these new abilities some commoners are getting. Another of my demons was spotted yesterday. It was kids again. I don't need to tell you the trouble this brings." Miss Farrar's elegant brows furrowed.
"No," she said, "you don't. This morning we've got new reports of strikes by dock workers and machinists, walkouts, demonstrations, not just in London, but the provinces too. It's being organised by men and women with these unusual powers. We're going to have to round them up."
But the cause, Jane, what is it?"
"We can find out when they're safely in the tower. We've spies working through the pubs now, getting information. We'll come down hard. Anything more?"
"We need to discuss the latest attack in Kent, too. But that can wait till council."
Miss Farrar reached out 2 slender fingers and unzipped her case, pulling back the cloth to expose a small crystal orb, blue-white and perfect, with a flattened base. She pushed it toward the center of the desk.
"My turn," she said. The magician sat up a little.
"One of your spies?"
"Yes. Now, pay attention, John. This is important. You know that Mr. Devereux has asked me to keep close watch on our magicians, in case anyone tries to follow in the footsteps of Duval and Lovelace."
Mr. Mandrake nodded. "More than the American rebels, more than their enemies in Europe, more than the angry commoners demonstrating on the streets, the Prime Minister feared his ministers, the men and women who sat at his table and drank his wine. It was a justified anxiety. His colleagues had ambitions. Nevertheless, it distracted him from other pressing business."
"What have you found?" he asked.
"Something." She passed a hand across the orb, leaning forward so that her long black hair fell down around her face. Clearing his throat, Mandrake leaned forward too, enjoying, as always, her scent, her shape, their shared proximity. Dangerous and feline as she was, Miss Farrow's company had its charms. She spoke a few words. Grains of blue ran away across the surface of the orb to collect in a pool near the bottom. The upper surface was left clear. Here an image formed, a face of shadows. It flickered, moved, but did not draw near. Miss Farrow looked up.
"This is Yol," she said. "Yol has been keeping watch on a certain junior magician who has aroused my interest. Name of Palmer, second level. Works in the Home Office. He has been passed over for promotion several times and is a frustrated man. Yesterday, Palmer reported in sick. He did not go to work. Instead, he left his apartment on foot and made his way to an inn near Whitechapel. He wore common workman's clothes. Yol here followed him and can relay what occurred. I think it will interest you."
Mandrake made a non-committal gesture.
"Please proceed."
Jane Farrar snapped her fingers and spoke into the orb.
"Show me the inn with sound."
The shadowy face retreated, vanished. An image formed inside the orb. Rafters, whitewashed walls, a trestle table beneath a hanging brass light. Smoke drifted against grimy pebble-glass windows. The viewpoint was low down. It was as if they were lying on the floor. Dowdy women passed above, and men in rough-cut suits. Faintly, as if from far away, came laughter, coughing, and the chink of glasses. A man sat at the trestle table, a burly gentleman in middle age, somewhat pink about the face, with grey flecks in his hair. He wore a shabby overcoat and a soft cap. His eyes ranged ceaselessly back and forth, evidently scanning the people in the inn. Mandrake leaned closer, taking in a gentle breath. Farrah's perfume was especially strong that day. There was something pomegranate-y about it.
"That's Palmer, isn't it?" he asked. "This is an odd angle we've got. Too low."
She nodded.
"Yol was a mouse by the skirting board. He wished to be unobtrusive, but it was a costly error, wasn't it, Yol?"
She stroked the surface of the orb. A voice from within, whimpering and meek.
"Yes, mistress."
Yes. That's Palmer. Ordinarily, a very dapper fellow. Now, this is important. It's hard to see from down here, but he has a pint of beer in his hand."
"Remarkable," Mandrake murmured.
"This being a pub and all."
"Definitely pomegranates. And possibly a hint of lemon."
"Just wait. He's watching for someone."
Mandrake considered the figure in the orb. As was to be expected in a magician among commoners, Mr. Palmer seemed ill at ease. His eyes moved constantly. Sweat glistened on his neck and shiny forehead. Twice he lifted his glass as if to drink his ale. Twice he halted with it at his lips and replaced it slowly on the table out of sight.
"Nervous," Mandrake said. "Yes. Poor, poor Palmer."
She spoke softly, but something in her tone carried the sharpness of a knife. Mandrake breathed in again. That hint of tartness was just right. Set off the sweeter scent quite nicely. Miss Farrow coughed.
"Something wrong with your chair, Mandrake?" she inquired. "Any further forward and you'll be in my lap."
He looked up hurriedly from the orb, narrowly avoiding crashing his forehead into hers.
"Sorry, Farrow, sorry.
He cleared his throat, spoke in a deep voice. "It's just the tension. Can't pull myself away. I wonder what this Palmer's game is. A most suspicious character." He pulled absently at a cuff. Miss Farrah regarded him for a moment, then gestured at the orb.
"Well, observe."
Into view from the side of the orb came a newcomer, carrying a pint of beer. He went bareheaded, his ginger hair slicked back, dirty worker's boots and trousers shuffling beneath a long black raincoat. With casual but deliberate steps, he drew near to Mr. Palmer, who had shuffled over on his bench to make room for him. The newcomer sat. He placed his beer upon the table, and pushed his glasses higher on his little nose. Mr. Mandrake was transfixed.
"Wait,"
he hissed.
"I know him."
"Yol," Farrah ordered, "halt the scene." The two men in the orb were half turning their heads to greet one another. At her command, the image froze.
"That's good," Farrah said. "You recognize him?"
"Yes. That's Jenkins. Clive Jenkins. Worked in internal affairs with me. Still may do, for all I know. Secretary level. Going nowhere. Well, now, this is interesting."
"You wait!"
Her fingers snapped. Mandrake noted their pale pink nail polish, the soft colour of her cuticles. The image in the orb restarted. The heads of the two men turned, nodded at each other, looked away. The newcomer, Clive Jenkins, took a sip of beer. His lips moved. Half a second later, his voice, tinny and distorted, was audible in the orb.
"Now then, Palmer. Things are moving fast, and it's decision time. We need to know if you're in or if you're out."
Mr. Palmer took a long drink from his glass. His face gleamed with perspiration. His eyes were never still. He mumbled rather than spoke.
"I need more information."
Jenkins laughed, adjusted his spectacles.
"Relax, relax. I'm not going to bite you, Palmer. Information you'll get, but first we need proof of your good intentions."
The other man made an odd champing motion with his lips and teeth.
"When have I ever given you reason to doubt me?"
"You haven't. But you haven't given us much reason to believe in you, either. We need proof."
"How? You mean a test?"
"Of sorts. Mr. Hopkins needs to see your commitment for himself. You could be police, for all we know. Working for Devereux, or that bitch Farrah."
He took another sip of beer.
"Can't be too careful."
Outside the orb, in another time and another place, John Mandrake looked up at Jane Farrah and raised an eyebrow. She smiled lazily, showing a pointed canine.
"Hopkins," he began. "You think that's the same one?"
"The scholar who showed Duval how to work the golems?" Farrah said. "The missing link of the last conspiracy?"
"Yes, I do. But listen."
Mr. Palmer was in the middle of a red-faced expostulation, working himself up into an agony of wounded reproach. Clive Jenkins said nothing. Finally, Palmer's tirade finished. He subsided like a limp balloon.
"Well, what do you want me to do?" he said. "I'm warning you, Jenkins. You'd better not be setting me up."
He raised his glass to refresh himself. As he did so, Jenkins seemed to flinch. His patched elbow knocked the other's arm. The pint glass jerked, beer dashed against the table. Palmer gave a little mew of anger.
"You clumsy fool!"
Jenkins offered no apology. "If you do what's required," he said, "you'll reap the rewards along with me and the rest. You're to meet him here."
"When?"
"Then. That's all. I'm going now." Without another word, the slight, ginger-haired man slipped out from behind the trestle table and disappeared from view. For a few minutes Mr. Palmer remained sitting, his red face blank and desperate. Then he, too, departed. Miss Farrah snapped her fingers. The image faded. Far in the distance, the face of shadows reluctantly returned. Farrah sat back in her chair.
"Needless to say," she said, "Yol failed us. From his vantage point as a mouse, he could not see the surface of the table. He did not think that Jenkins had spilled the beer on purpose."
nor that he had written the hour and place of meeting in the liquid on the table. Well, Yole followed Palmer for the remainder of the day and saw nothing. That night he reported back to me. While he was so doing, Palmer left his flat and did not come back. Evidently he went to keep his appointment with the mysterious Hopkins.
John Mandrake tapped his fingers together eagerly.
We shall have to interrogate Mr. Palmer when he returns. Therein lies a problem. At dawn this morning, engineers working at the Rotherhithe sewage works saw something lying on a midden. They thought at first it was a pile of rags.
Mandrake hesitated.
Not. I fear so. It was the body of Mr. Palmer. He had been stabbed through the heart.
Oh, Mandrake said. Ah. That's awkward.
It is indeed. But it is promising, too.
Jane Farrar passed a hand across the orb. It darkened, became a cold, dull blue.
It means that this Clive Jenkins of yours and this Hopkins are planning something big. Big enough to involve quite casual murder. And we're onto it.
Her eyes gleamed with excitement. Her long black hair was a little dishevelled. Several wisps fell down across her brow. Her face was flushed, and she was breathing quickly. Mandrake adjusted his collar slightly.
"Why are you telling me this now, outside counsel?"
"Because I trust you, John, and I don't trust any of the others."
She pushed the wisps away from her eye.
"Whitwell and Mortensen are both intriguing against us. You know that. We've no friends in council apart from the PM. If we can flush out these traitors ourselves, our position will be admirably strengthened."
He nodded.
"True. Well, it's clear what to do. Send a demon to tail Clive Jenkins and see if he can lead us to the truth."
Miss Farrar zipped the crystal orb into its bag and stood.
"I'll leave that to you, if I may. Yole's hopeless, and my others are all on assignment. It's observation only at this stage. You won't need anything powerful. Or are all your gin tied up?"
Mandrake looked toward the silent pentacles.
"No, no," he said slowly. "I'm sure I'll be able to find someone."
Chapter 6 Bartimaeus.
I ask you. You fluff a mission, you harass a messenger, and you flatly refuse an order to return. Then you sit back waiting for the magician to respond. And nothing happens. For hours. No summons, no attempted punishment, nothing. What kind of master do you call that? If there's one thing that really annoys me, it's being ignored. Harsh treatment I can stand. Insulting gestures, likewise. At least they show you're having some kind of effect. But just being left to fester as if I were no better than that tuppenny imp in the scrying glass, that makes me more than a little annoyed. The day was half done by the time I felt the first tweaking in my essence. Firm, insistent, like razor wire passing through my vitals. The summons at last. Good. Time to go. Not for me any fearful reluctance or holding back. I stood up from the broken chimney, stretched, removed the concealment upon myself, scared a passing dog, made a rude noise to an old lady in the next garden, and lobbed the chimney as far as I could into the street. Owing to my weakness, it didn't make it across the pavement. But boy, the gesture was savage. No more messing about. I was still Bartimaeus of Uruk, Alarish, and Alexandria. This time I meant business. I allowed the summons to pull my essence up and away. The street fast disintegrated in a welter of lights and coloured bands. A second later, these coalesced once more into the shape of a typical summoning hall. Strip lights on the ceilings, multiple pentacles on the floor. The information ministry, as usual. I allowed my body to reform in Kitty Jones's guise. It was simpler than trying to think of something else. Right. The cursed Mandrake. Where was he? There. Sitting behind a desk, pen in hand, staring at a wadge of papers laid before him. He wasn't even glancing in my direction. I cleared my throat, put dainty hands on hips, prepared to speak.
Bartimaeus.
A gentle voice.
too low to be mandrakes. I turned, saw a delicate young woman with vole-brown hair sitting at another desk in a neighbouring pentacle. It was Piper, my master's assistant, today doing her best to be severe. Her forehead was puckered in something resembling a frown. Her fingertips were steepled sternly. She eyed me like a cross schoolmistress in a kindergarten. "Where have you been, Bartimaeus?" she began. "You should have returned this morning when requested. Mr. Mandrake has had to exert himself to draw you back when he is so desperately busy. It isn't good enough, you know. Your behaviour is really becoming most tiresome." This wasn't what I had had in mind at all. I drew myself up. "Tiresome?" I cried. "Tiresome? Have you forgotten whom you are addressing? This is Bartimaeus here. Sacra al-Jinni. Ngorso the Mighty. Builder of walls. Destroyer of empires. I have 20 names and titles in as many tongues, and my exploits reverberate in every syllable. Do not attempt to degrade me, woman. If you wish to live, I advise you to pick up your skirts and depart at speed. I intend to speak to Mr. Mandrake alone." She clicked her tongue. "You simply are being quite impossible today, Bartimaeus. I think you should know better. Now we have a little job here for you."
"What? Not so fast."
In the pentacle I gave a half-step forward. Sparks snapped from my eyes, and a nimbus of coral fire trembled upon my skin. "I'll have things out with Mandrake first." "I'm afraid the minister is currently indisposed."
"Indisposed? Baloney, I can see him right there."
"He is busy working on today's news pamphlet. A deadline approaches."
"Well, he can leave off inventing his lies for a few minutes. I want a word."
As part of his attempt to appease the commoners, Mandrake had initiated a series of penny dreadful pamphlets, which told heroic tales of British soldiers fighting in the American wilderness. A typical title was Real War Stories. They were illustrated by bad woodcuts and purported to be true accounts of recent events. Needless to say, the American magicians were savage and cruel, using the blackest magic and the most hideous demons. Conversely, the square-jawed Brits always insisted on good manners and fair play, and invariably got out of scrapes by improvising homemade weapons from fence posts, tin cans, and pieces of string. The war was depicted as being both necessary and virtuous. It was the old, old story. I've seen imps carve similar claims on official stelae up and down the Nile Delta, defending pharaonic wars. The people tended to ignore those, too. Miss Piper wrinkled her nose. "You can have nothing worthwhile to say to him. Now please attend to your mission." I turned away from her, addressed the figure at the desk.
"Oi, Mandrake!"
No answer. I repeated myself, only louder. The papers flapped and fluttered on his desk. The magician ran his hand through his short, cropped hair and looked up with a vaguely pained expression. It was as though he were being called upon to remember an old injury in a sensitive spot. He turned to his assistant. "Miss Piper, please inform Bartimaeus that I'm not remotely interested in his complaints. Remind him that most masters would have punished him severely for his incompetence in battle, and that he is lucky to be alive. That's all." He picked up his pen once more. Miss Piper opened her mouth to speak, but I was faster.
"Please inform that stubble-headed pipsqueak," I snapped, "that it is imperative he dismiss me on the instant. My powers, while still awesome, are somewhat reduced and need reviving. If he does not agree to this reasonable and just demand, I shall be forced to act in desperation against my interests and his own."
She frowned. "What's that last bit mean?" I raised an eyebrow. "He knows." I turned to Mandrake. "You do know, don't you?" He glanced at me.
"Yes, obviously."
Too right he did. His birth name hung over his head like a naked sword. With portentous deliberation, he set down his pen once more.
"Miss Piper," he said, "please point out to that pernicious demon that should a certain thought of betrayal even flicker across his mind. I will relocate him to the Boston marshes, where every day a dozen gin are seen to perish.
Tell him that this breaks no ice now, buddy. My defences are so low that I'm liable to perish doing his shopping. What do I lose where it happens?
Tell him that he surely exaggerates his weakness.
This doesn't sound like the Bartimaeus who rubbed shoulders with Solomon.
And Faustus? And Zarbustibol?
Faustus? Zarbustibol? Whoever. I'm not giving a complete list.
However, tell him, Ms. Piper, that if he successfully completes the following mission, I shall agree to his temporary dismissal for purposes of recuperation, and let him be satisfied with that.
I sniffed disparagingly.
Tell him that this offer will only be acceptable if the mission is simple, swift, and utterly without danger.
Tell him... Oh, for heaven's sake, just tell him what the mission is and have done.
With a flurry of papers and a squeaking of his leather chair, the magician returned to his work. Miss Piper's head came to a standstill. It had been swiveling from side to side like a worried owl's. She rubbed her neck gingerly.
So get on with it, then, I said.
She looked a bit hurt by my curt tone, but I was in no mood for niceties. Once again, Mandrake had treated me with contempt and derision. Once again, he'd ignored my threats and entreaties. For the thousandth time, I vowed revenge. Perhaps I should just risk America. Go out there and chance my arm in battle. I'd survived such things before, but not when I was anything like as weak as this. No, I'd have to recharge my strength first, and that meant agreeing to this final mission. I waited grimly. On the other side of the room I heard Mandrake's pen go travelling across the paper, scratching out more lies. Miss Piper was evidently relieved that the confrontation was over.
"Well," she said, smiling breezily, "I'm sure you'll find this very simple, Bartimaeus. We wish you to trail a minor magician named Clive Jenkins, keeping track of his every act and movement. Do not allow yourself to be seen or sensed. He is engaged in some kind of conspiracy against the government and has been involved in murder. Furthermore, we know he is working for the fugitive scholar Hopkins."
That aroused my interest in a vague sort of way. It had been years since we'd had a lead on him. But I kept Kitty's face in sullen teenage mode.
"Jenkins, is he strong?"
She frowned.
"I don't think so."
My master looked up, snorted.
"Jenkins? Hardly." "He works in internal affairs," Miss Piper said. "Second level. Has an imp named Trucklet. We know that he has been trying to corrupt other low-level magicians. It is not clear why. He is certainly in communication with Clem Hopkins."
"That's the priority," Mandrake said. "Find Hopkins. Don't act or attack. We know you're as weak as a weevil, Bartimaeus. Just find out where he is. Also, discover what they're up to. If you succeed, I'll—" "Oh, blast it!"
The telephone on his desk had rung. He picked up the receiver.
"Yes. Oh, hello, Makepeace."
He rolled his eyes to the ceiling.
"Yes, yes, I'd love to drop by, love to. But I can't right now. I'm off to council shortly. In fact, I'm late already. What's it about?"
Hmm.
Very mysterious. Maybe later this. All right. I'll try. See you then."
He thumped the phone down.
"Got to go, Piper. I'll finish the Boston siege story over lunch. Send it to you by imp later, all right? We can get it printed for the evening fairs."
He was standing up now, stuffing papers into a briefcase.
"Anything else you need to know, Bartimaeus? I don't mean excuses or whinges. Haven't time for them."
My version of Kitty gritted her teeth. "What about backup? If I get to this Hopkins, there'll be more than an imp guarding him."
"He's just a scholar, Bartimaeus. But even if he's got defences, we don't want you to wade in.
I can send Cormac Codron and the others to deal with him presently, and Miss Farrah's got a lot of police on standby.
Just report in to me when you've got the information. I'll give you an open-door injunction. You can return to me whenever you're ready."
"Where will you be?"
"Westminster Hall this afternoon, Devereux's mansion at Richmond through the evening. Tonight, my house."
His briefcase clipped shut. He was eager to depart.
"Where is Jenkins to be found now?"
"Internal Affairs Building, 16 Whitehall.
Office at the back. He's a diminutive, ginger-haired little twerp. Anything else on your mind?
You wouldn't want to hear it.
No doubt. One last point, Bartimaeus, he said. I've given you my word, but you might encourage me to keep it if you drop that particular guise.
He looked at me then, head on, almost for the first time.
Think about it.
He made a complex sign. The bonds that kept me imprisoned in the circle wrapped themselves about me, spun in opposite directions, and sent me spiraling out into the world.
Chapter 7 Kitty
Bartimaeus, by name of the demon Sacra al-Jinni, mentioned in Procopius and Michelot. A middling-ranking jinni of ancient standing, great ingenuity, and no little power. First recorded in Uruk, later in Jerusalem. Fought at the Battle of Al-Arish against the Assyrians. Known masters have included Gilgamesh, Solomon, Zarbustibol, Heraclius, Hauser. Bartimaeus's other names of power include Ngorso, Necho, Reket. Linnaean ranking 6. Dangerous. Still extant. Kitty lowered the book into her lap and stared out of the bus window. From her place on the upper deck she could see the sinews and tendons of the magician's rule running up and down the London streets. Night police strolled among pedestrians. Vigilant spheres drifted on every corner. Small, swift points of light passed far above in the afternoon sky. Ordinary people went about their business, keeping their eyes carefully averted from the watchers all around. Kitty sighed. Even with its armies in action far away, the government's power was too complete, too obvious to allow dissent. Commoners alone could do nothing, that much was clear. They needed assistance of a different kind. She glanced back down at Trismegistus's manual, screwed up her eyes at the small, crabbed typeface, and reread the passage for the umpteenth time. The names Necho and Reket were new to her, but the rest was drearily familiar. The meagre list of masters, for instance. Though nothing much was known about the faces of Gilgamesh or Solomon, they were certainly adult kings. Heraclius was a magician emperor, a warrior, not a child. As for Zarbustibol, she'd located a description of him months ago in an old inventory of Arabian masters. He was renowned about the Red Sea for his hook nose and protruding warts. Hauser had been youthful, right enough, but he was North European, fair and freckled. An engraving in one of Mr. Button's books had told her so. None of them could have been the dark-haired, dark-skinned boy whose guise Bartimaeus was fond of using. Kitty shook her head, shut the book, and dropped it into her bag. She was probably just wasting time. She should forget her hunch and make the summons anyway. Lunchtime had come and gone, and the bus was crowded with men and women returning to work. Some spoke together in hushed tones, others, worn out already, dozed and nodded. A man sitting across the aisle from Kitty was reading the latest instalment of Real War Stories, the Information Ministry's regular account of the war's progress. The front cover of the pamphlet was decorated by a woodcut. It showed a British soldier running up a hillside, bayonet at the ready. He was noble, determined, a classical statue in motion. At the top of the hill, an American rebel cowered, his face contorted with anger, terror, and other unpleasant emotions. He wore an old-style magician's robe, drawn to seem ludicrous, effeminate. His arms were raised defensively. Beside him sat his ally, a minor demon in similar pose. Its face was wizened and wicked. It wore, in miniature, the same clothes as the magician. The British soldier had no demon. The caption below the woodcut read, "Another Boston Triumph." Kitty curled her lip contemptuously at the blatant propaganda of the woodcut. That was Mandrake's work. He was head of information now. And to think she'd let him live. But it had been the jinni, Bartimaeus, who had encouraged her to do it. To act, to spare the magician's life. And 3 years later, this still puzzled and intrigued her. Nothing that she had known about demons had quite prepared her for Bartimaeus's personality. Their conversations, framed against a backdrop of fear and danger, remained fresh in her mind. Full of vitality, insight, and above all, an unexpected rapport. He had opened a door for her, giving her a glimpse of a historical process she had never guessed at. Thousands of years of magicians enslaving demons, forcing them to lend their power. Thousands of years, during which time a dozen empires had risen to glory, waned, then crumbled. The pattern recurred again and again. Demons were summoned. Magicians fought their way to wealth and fame. Stagnation set in. Commoners discovered inherent abilities they didn't know they had. Magical resilience built up through the generations that allowed them to rebel against their rulers. The magicians fell. New ones appeared elsewhere and began the process once more. So it went on, an endless cycle of strife. The question was, could it be broken? A horn blared. With a jerk, the bus came to a sudden stop. Kitty lurched back into her seat and craned her neck against the window in an effort to see the cause. From somewhere beyond the front of the bus, a young man came flailing through the air. He landed heavily on the pavement, lay there an instant, and began to rise. Two night police, grey-uniformed, shiny of boot and cap, hurried into view. They flung themselves upon the youth, but he fought and kicked, punched his way free. He struggled to his feet. One officer produced a stick from her belt. She spoke a word. A glimmering blue current crackled at its end. The crowd that had gathered drew back in alarm. The young man retreated slowly. Kitty saw that his head was bloodied, his eyes wild. The policewoman advanced, waving her jolt stick. A sudden lunge, a jab. The current caught the young man in the chest. He jerked and twitched a moment. Smoke billowed from his burning clothes. Then he laughed. A harsh and mirthless sound, like the calling of a crow. His hand reached out and grasped the stick at its active end. Blue energies juddered on his skin, but he seemed impervious. In two quick movements, he had seized the stick, reversed it, and sent the policewoman jerking back upon the pavement in a flash of light. Her limbs twitched, her body arched, subsided. She lay quite still. The young man threw the jolt stick aside, turned upon his heel, and without a backward glance disappeared down a side alley. The silent crowd parted for him. With a grinding shudder and a rumble of gears, the bus set off. A woman sitting in front of Kitty shook her head at nobody in particular. "The war," she said. "It's causing all this trouble." Kitty looked at her watch. 15 minutes to the library. She closed her eyes. It was half true. The war was causing most of the trouble, both at home and abroad. But the spreading resilience of the commoners was helping to fan the flames. 6 months previously, the war minister, Mr. Mortensen, had implemented a new policy. In a bid to bludgeon the American rebels into submission, he determined to dramatically increase the size of the government force. To this end, he enacted the Mortensen Doctrine, a policy of mobilization across the country. Recruitment offices were opened, and commoners were encouraged to sign up to the armed forces. Lured by the prospect of preferential jobs on their return, many men did so. After a few days of training, they sailed for America on special troopships. Months passed. The expected return of the conquering heroes did not materialize. Everything went quiet. Information from the colonies was hard to come by. Government statements became elusive. At length, rumors began, perhaps spread by traders operating across the Atlantic. The army was bogged down deep in enemy territory. Two battalions had been massacred. Many men were dead. Some had fled into the trackless forests and had never been seen again. There was talk of starvation and other horrors. The recruitment office queues dwindled and died away. A sullenness stole imperceptibly across the faces of people in the London streets. In due course, passive resentment turned to action.
It began with a few disjointed episodes, far-flung and brief, each of which could be ascribed to random local causes. In one town, a mother conducted a solitary protest, hurling a rock through the window of a recruitment office. In another, a group of labourers set down their tools and refused to toil for their daily pittance. Three merchants tipped a truckload of precious goods, golden oats, fine flour, sun-cured hams, upon the Whitehall Road, and dousing it with oil, ignited it, sending a fragile ribbon of smoke into the sky. A minor magician from the eastern colonies, perhaps maddened by years of foreign diet, ran screaming into the War Ministry with an elemental sphere in his hand. In seconds he had activated the sphere, destroying himself and two young receptionists in a maelstrom of raging air. While none of the incidents was as dramatic as the attacks once carried out by the traitor Duval, or even by the moribund resistance, they had greater staying power in the public mind. Despite the best efforts of Mr. Mandrake at the Information Ministry, they were discussed repeatedly in markets, at workplaces, in pubs and cafes, until by the strange alchemy of gossip and rumour, they were joined together into one big story, becoming the symptoms of a collective protest against the magician's rule. But it was a protest without teeth, and Kitty, who had tried active rebellion in her time, was under no illusions about how it was going to end. Each evening, at work in the Frog Inn, she heard proposals of strikes and demonstrations, but no suggestion of how to prevent the magician's demons from cracking down. Yes, a few scattered individuals had resilience, as she had, but that alone was not enough. Allies were needed, too. The bus set her down in a peaceful, leafy road south of Oxford Street. Shouldering her bag, she walked the last two blocks to the London Library. The guard had seen her often, both singly and in the company of Mr. Button. Nevertheless, he ignored her greeting, held out his hand for her pass, and scanned it sourly from his perch on a high stool behind a desk. Without comment, he ushered her on. Kitty smiled sweetly and strolled into the library foyer. The library filled five labyrinthine floors, extending across the width of three townhouses in the corner of a quiet square. Although out of bounds to commoners, it was not primarily concerned with magical texts, but instead with works that the authorities considered dangerous or subversive in the wrong hands. These included books on history, on mathematics, astronomy, and other stagnant sciences, as well as literature that had been forbidden since Gladstone's day. Few of the leading magicians had the time or inclination to visit it, but Mr. Button, from whose attentions few historical texts were safe, sent Kitty to browse there frequently. As usual, the library was almost deserted. Looking into the alcoves stretching away from the marbled stairs, Kitty made out one or two elderly gentlemen, sitting crumpled below the windows in the apricot afternoon light. One held a newspaper loosely in his hands. Another definitely slept. Along a distant aisle, a young woman was sweeping the floor. "Shht, shht, shht," went the broom, and faint clouds of dust seeped through the shelving to the aisles on either side. Kitty had a list of titles to borrow on Mr. Button's behalf, but she also had an agenda of her own. After 2 years' regular visits, she knew her way around. Before long, she was in a secluded corridor on the second floor, standing in front of the demonology section. Necco, wreck it. Her knowledge of ancient languages was non-existent. These names might belong in almost any culture. Babylonian? Assyrian? On a hunch, she tried Egyptian. She consulted several general demon listings, all bound in cracked black leather. Yellowed pages, covered in tight, faint columns of script. Half an hour passed. She found nothing. A brief consultation with the library index led her to a remote alcove beside a window. A window seat with purple cushions waited invitingly. She hauled down several specialist Egyptian almanacs and began to search. Almost immediately, in a portly dictionary, she found something. Wreck-it. English translation, lapwing. This bird symbolized slavery to the Egyptians, occurs commonly in tomb art and in hieroglyphs
on magicians' papyri. Demons with this byname recur in the old, new, and late periods. Demons plural? That was frustrating. But she'd pinned the epoch down for sure. Bartimaeus had been employed in Egypt. For some of that time, at least, he had been known as Reckitt. In her mind's eye, Kitty saw the jinni as she remembered him. Dark, slight, wearing a simple wrap-around kilt. From what she knew of the appearance of the Egyptians, Kitty felt she might be onto something. For another hour she sat there, flipping contentedly through the dusty pages. Some books were useless, written in foreign tongues, or in phrases so abstruse that the sentences seemed to coil up on themselves before her eyes. The rest were dense and forbidding. They gave her lists of pharaohs, of civil servants, of the warrior priests of Ra. They provided tables of known summonings, of surviving records, of obscure demons sent on mundane tasks. It was a daunting search, and more than once Kitty's head nodded. She was startled back into life by police sirens in the distance, by shouts and chanting from a nearby street, once by an elderly magician blowing his nose loudly as he shuffled down the passage. The autumn sun was lowering level with the library window. Its rays warmed the seat with a golden light. She glanced at her watch. 4:15. Not long before the library closed, and she hadn't even found Mr. Button's books. In 3 hours she must be at work, too. It was an important night, and George Fox of the Frog Inn was a stickler for punctuality. Wearily she pulled another volume across the window seat and flipped it open. Just another 5 minutes, then. Kitty blinked. There it was. A list, 8 pages long, of selected demons, tabulated alphabetically. Now, then. Kitty scanned down it with practiced speed. Paimos, Paeri, Penrenutet, Ramos. Aha! Reckitt. 3 of them. Reckitt, 1. Afrit. Slave of Sneferu, 4th dynasty and others, of legendarily vicious temperament, killed at Khartoum. Reckitt, 2. Jinni, by name of Quishog, guardian of the necropolis of Thebes, 18th dynasty, morbid tendencies. Reckitt, 3. Jinni, also named Nectanebo or Necho, energetic but unreliable. Slave of Ptolemaeus of Alexandria. Flourished 120s BC. It was the third one. It had to be. The entry was shortness itself, but Kitty felt a surge of excitement in her veins. A new master, a new possibility. Ptolemaeus. The name was quite familiar. She was sure she'd heard Mr. Button mention it. Sure even that he owned books with it in the title. Ptolemaeus. She racked her brains. Well, it would be easy enough to track down the reference when she got back. With fevered haste, Kitty noted down her findings in her jotter, snapped the elastic band around it, and shoved it into her tattered satchel. She gathered the books into an untidy pile, hoisted them into her arms, and returned them to the shelves. As she did so, the distant buzzer sounded in the foyer. The library was closing, and she'd still not got her master's books. Time to move. But it was with a definite sense of triumph that Kitty sprinted down the corridor. "Better look out, Bartimaeus," she thought as she ran. "Better look out. I'm closing in on you." Chapter 8. Nathaniel. The afternoon's council meeting was even less satisfactory than John Mandrake had feared. It took place in the Hall of Statues at Westminster, a rectangular room built of pink-grey stone, with soaring medieval vaulting high above, and thickly layered Persian rugs covering the flagstones. In a dozen niches along the walls stood life-size statues of the great magicians of the past. There at the end, austere and forbidding, was Gladstone.
Opposite him, flamboyant in a frock coat, his deadly rival Disraeli. All the succeeding prime ministers were featured, together with other notables. Not every alcove yet contained a statue, but Mr. Devereux, the current premier, had ordered the empty ones to be filled with sumptuous floral displays. It was guessed the vacant spaces reminded him of his own mortality. Globes of imp-light drifted against the ceiling, illuminating, in the centre of the room, a circular table of English oak, broad in diameter and polished to perfection by labouring imps. Around this sat the council, the great ones of the empire, toying with their pens and bottles of mineral water. Mr. Devereux had chosen a round table for reasons of diplomacy. Technically, no one person took precedence over another. An admirable policy, which had been undermined by his insistence on using a gigantic golden chair, ornately carved with swollen cherubs. Mr. Mortensen, the War Minister, had followed suit with an ostentatious seat of burnished redwood. Not to be outdone, Mr. Collins of the Home Office had responded with a monumental throne of emerald brocade, complete with perfumed tassels. So it went. Only John Mandrake and his erstwhile master, Ms. Jessica Whitwell, had resisted the temptation to somehow modify their seating. The placing of each magician's chair was likewise subtly fought over, until the situation had stabilized to reflect the factions that were opening up in council. Mr. Devereux's two favourites sat beside him, John Mandrake, the Information Minister, and Jane Farrar of the police. Beyond Farrar sat Ms. Whitwell and Mr. Collins, who were known to be sceptical about the direction of the war. Beyond Mandrake were Mr. Mortensen and Ms. Malbindi of the Foreign Office. It was their policies that the government was currently following. The meeting began inauspiciously with an advertisement. From a side room, a giant crystal orb came rumbling on a wheeled platform. It was pulled by a slave gang of implets, led by a foliate overseer, wielding a horsehair whip. As they drew near the table, the foliate uttered a cry, the implets sprang to attention, and with the cracking of the whip, vanished, one after the other, in clouds of coloured steam. The crystal orb glowed pink, then orange. In its centre appeared a broad and beaming face, which winked and spoke.
"Esteemed ladies and gentlemen of the council, let me remind you that we are only 2 days from the theatrical event of the decade, the society event of the year. Reserve your tickets now for the premiere of my latest work, based on the life of our beloved friend and leader, Mr. Rupert Devereux. Get ready to laugh, cry, tap your feet, and sing along to the choruses of From Wapping to Westminster, A Political Odyssey. Bring your partners, bring your friends, and don't forget your handkerchiefs. I, Quentin Makepeace, promise you all a sensational night."
The face faded. The orb went dark. The assembled ministers coughed and shuffled in their seats.
"Dear God," someone whispered, "it's a musical."
Mr. Devereux beamed around at them.
"Quentin's sweet gesture is a mite unnecessary," he said. "I'm sure you all already have your tickets."
So they had. There was little option. The day's business commenced. Mr. Mortensen gave a report of the latest news from America, brought by gin across the ocean. It was sour fare. Deadlock in the wilderness, minor skirmishes, nothing decisive gained. It had been so for weeks. John Mandrake barely listened. The account was predictable and depressing. It only increased the frustration that boiled within him. Everything was out of control. The war, the commoners, the situation across the empire. Something decisive needed to be done, and soon, if the nation was to be saved. And he knew what that something was. The staff of Gladstone, a weapon of incredible power, lay useless in the vaults below that very chamber, begging to be brought out by anyone with the talent to use it. If wielded effectively, it would destroy the rebels, cow Britain's enemies, send the commoners scampering back to work. But it needed a magician of the strongest level to command it, and Devereux was not that man. Hence, out of fear for his own position, he kept it safely locked away. Would Mandrake have been able to use the staff, given the opportunity? In all honesty, he didn't know. Perhaps.